Hi, I'm Marian McPartland. On Piano Jazz, over the years, we've often pushed the boundaries of jazz by featuring a wide variety of guest artists from outside the traditional jazz scene. And today's guest falls into that category, guitarist Nils Klein. I'm thrilled to have my good friend John Weber sit in the host chair and talk with him.
Thanks, Marian. I'm excited to be here talking with Nils Klein, one of the most exciting original guitarists working anywhere. He's widely known for his work with the critically acclaimed alternative rock band Wilco, and he's been playing freeform jazz and experimenting with sound textures since the 1970s. He's brought along his band, the Nils Klein Singers, and I'm thrilled to welcome the whole crew to Piano Jazz.
Thank you, John. It's lovely to be here.
I think Piano Jazz listeners and Wilco fans alike may be astonished to discover that a guitarist of your stature in the rock world has accumulated such an impressive resume in the jazz world as well.
Well, I don't know how impressive it is, but I am advanced in years to a certain extent, so I've accumulated some experiences. And I still do get to work with some really, really fine improvisers, and I treasure these experiences as well as what I'm doing with Wilco. It's very enjoyable. I started playing when I was about 11, but I was terrible and not all that serious until I heard some pretty serious music, Indian classical music, John Coltrane, Miles Davis, and progressive rock back then sort of inspired me to try to learn. So I tried to learn some things and ended up playing with some really pretty incredible people. I'm not quite sure how it happened.
What I love is I would bet that there's at least one Wilco fan out there who is listening to you right now saying, you know, I'm gonna listen to somebody he recommended. Nels recommended him. Who's this? John Coltrane. Let me download some of that. Somebody's life's going to be turned around because they heard you on this show, I promise. That's a conservative estimate. At least probably hundreds, if not thousands, of your fans are going to be checking you out and saying, hey, man.
I think a lot of people have heard John Coltrane by now. Maybe not some of the later work that I actually really like as much as anything. But certainly for me and my brother, sitting down in our friend's apartment in West L.A. in front of their portable hi-fi, I might call it at that point, and hearing Africa was pretty much the beginning of a journey that neither of us could have predicted. It was so mysterious and inspiring, and we just didn't even know how to process it, except that it was galvanizing, and we knew that everything had changed. My brother is listening to a lot of Frank Zappa already at this point for years, so his our friend of ours named David Hirschman loaned us that record. He had bought it for his dad, Jack Hirschman, the poet, and said, you like that Frank Zappa instrumental stuff, you might like this, which I thought was kind of odd because also, you know, Bessie's Blues and all these things were on. It was a Greatest Years Volume 1. So it was an edited version of Africa, but nonetheless had a profound impact. I don't know.
You know, and I gotta tell you, you have accumulated such an impressive resume in the jazz world, as I described, and I think some of the fans of the tremendously popular band Wilco, with whom you've recorded and toured since 2004, will be pleasantly surprised today, hearing your tremendous versatility and virtuosity and fluency in many different genres that perhaps they haven't heard you play before. So, to me, you've accomplished some really truly remarkable work.
Wow. Well, thanks.
I've been looking you up. I've been listening to you for a while, and in the decades leading up to joining Wilco, I'm going to ask you about some of those ensembles today and your musical adventures with them. And I'd like to get right into the music since we have the Singers. You know, is this what I think it is? Because I hear Singers and immediately I imagine that's prefaced by either Ray Conniff or Ray Charles.
Both.
In tribute to, is it tell me if I'm anywhere close. Is it almost, I remember you had another closely named, the Nils Klein Trio.
Right.
Back in the 90s.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is another trio. And rather than call it Nils Klein Trio, I was somewhat stymied as I searched for something other than trio, unit, band, group, ensemble. And so I thought singers was a sort of humorous, if slightly arch, generic term for a band collected together. And then we called the first record instrumentals. So I thought that kind of explained it.
That's very cool, and it's very, very in deference to the trio, which had a terrific life of its own.
Yeah, I wanted to honor that as a separate band because that was, well, now this group's been together longer, but that was an almost 8-year run with that group with Michael Preussner and Bob Mayer. Original bass player was Mark London Sims, but Bob Mayer did most of those years on the Fender bass.
Beautiful work with him. Sudden Interest is the one I tried to transcribe. I did transcribe, and I thought, come on.
I can't believe it. I never even wrote the guitar part out myself. I actually kind of blew it back in those days, not writing out all my guitar parts because my memory's not what it once was, I'll tell you.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? Hey, I might not have immediately guessed that you were a big fan of legendary guitarist Jim Hall.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody could listen to Jim Hall and not be somewhat in awe of his musicality, but I think that the further you dig into his work, the more you realize what an incredibly free player he is, and how I think he's absolutely like a non-generic, non-lick kind of musician, somebody for whom the guitar, I think, is maybe still a beautiful instrument unto itself because he uses a lot of idiomatic sounds on the guitar that a lot of jazz players sort of eschew. But also from his work with Jimmy Giuffre in Los Angeles, playing some very advanced music and some very free music, to all the work that he's done in all the different groups and duos and everything else, I think that he's always forward-looking, never boring, and absolutely inspiring. So I wrote a little ditty for him actually many years ago. It's kind of an old line called Blues 2, T-O-O, and I dedicated it to him because I just thought there was something a little Hallish about the writing. Certainly there won't be much Hallish about the guitar playing, but love and respect to Jim Hall.
I would love to hear you guys play Blues 2 with drummer Scott Amendola, bassist Devin Hoff, and we have a guest keyboardist today as well. Yuka Honda is going to be playing with you a little bit later.
She'll come up a little later.
Let's hear Blues 2. Thank you. That was awesome. That was I wish Jim Hall could hear that. Wonderful tribute to Jim Hall and the guys. My God, Scott Amendola on drums and Devin Hoff on bass. Excellent playing. Does it now when you come you write a little blueprint for a tune like that and do you shape it in the studio or how do you? Because I imagine it probably evolves over time. How do you?
Well, that piece is one of the few pieces I've written that probably could actually be called a jazz piece. So it's really just a line. And then what happens after that is pretty much absolute freedom. I have given guidelines to this piece, but I think we don't really follow them too well. The guidelines were to reference in some way what I would call the cool school of the 50s at its, I think, most avant-garde, which is to say some of the stuff that Shelly Manne and Jimmy Giuffre and Shorty Rogers and people were doing along with Jim Hall. And I think they were trying to break up a lot of things, a lot of patterns that were associated with the bop movement maybe and whatnot, and trying to borrow from, I think, what was going on in contemporary composed music to a certain extent, concert music so-called. So we do that in our own way, but at this point the piece has been around for a while and we just play it live, and the version on the record is exactly the way we would play it live as far as the approach. There is a recording on a record called The Giant Pin that's just a different version of what you just heard, pretty much.
You can tell that you guys play together a lot because I can hear all three of you, and I don't know who I'm paying attention to all three at exactly the same time, which is as it should be. And regarding your playing on it, I mean, your tone, man, it's like you've never stayed frozen in one place for 3+ decades of playing. Mm. I can tell it's you, but I mean, the thing is, you seem to flawlessly adapt to whatever ensemble you happen to be leading or performing with.
That's a happy accident. But I am trying to do that, actually. I don't play a jazz type of guitar, in spite of the fact that it's called a Jazz Master, and so I'm trying to get a lovely tone out of the guitar, and I think the combination of having maybe acquired a sense of tone over the years, which I certainly lacked in my earlier days, and the challenge of playing a different amplifier pretty much everywhere I go has just given me the ability to at least dial in, when possible, a listenable tone. I have a lot of effects pedals that I won't probably be using as much as usual on this show because a lot of them create horrendous noises and distortions. And I don't know, out of pure respect just for Marion McPartland, I don't think I can actually do that today. I'll use a little bit of overdrive probably.
But you do actually do some really, really remarkable things with the sound. In other words, I mean, your effects pedals have greatly expanded the timbral palette normally available to guitar, acoustic guitar, and you're able to create this wall of sound, not to borrow the Phil Spector, but which is only possible with electric instruments.
And indeed, that's a malleable instrument, the electric guitar.
I'll tell you something. One of the things I love about your soloing when you're using the effects pedals, and I'm a big defender of effects pedals, by the way. I used to play heavy metal guitar back when I was, you know, young and a danger to society.
Nice.
Yeah.
You're still wearing all black, I see.
It still fits from, you know. Now, anyway, back to the music. What I love also is that it's this piano-less. There's just you got the melody, you got the bass, you got the drums, and it's just reminds me of the, you know, the Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, or the Ornette stuff with Don Cherry.
I love that stuff.
Yeah, just there's, you know, guess what the harmony is. It's like a connect the dots picture, and it's and the lines are really, really beautiful. And I mean, again, you're adapting to every ensemble you're in, and not many people are born with that gift, that listening kind of skill. So I want to ask, did you have a good-natured mentor who taught you how to musically fit in with all these varied ensembles?
Not really. I think that's my personality. I learned a lot about music from a man named Eric Von Essen, who was kind of my musical partner for many, many years, I guess almost 17 years or something. He's no longer alive, but playing Eric's music, and he was a very accomplished guitarist, not just a contrabassist and pianist and chromatic harmonica player, but played some good guitar, and he showed me a lot on the guitar. I never had a guitar teacher other than Eric, really, show me much of anything. A guy once showed me a diatonic scale and chords, and that was when I was in high school, and that was about the beginning of you know, the vistas opening up and the angels singing, coming down from the heavens. It was really eye-opening, but I didn't really learn from teachers on the instrument. And as far as fitting in, I just think it's my personality. I have a desire to be, you know, just part of the orchestra. And in spite of all the, I guess, somewhat chaotic or frenzied performances that you might hear on recordings, I don't really have a huge desire to call attention to myself. I just want to play music that I like, you know?
You know, that is very true. And I did notice that when I did listen to the quartet, it was called Quartet Music, Eric Van Essen's group in the late 80s. And man, it was just a wonderful balance. You're playing acoustic guitar and the stuff. You're playing a lot of tunes in 7 and 5 and all these nice time signatures. And it was just, I mean, Wilco fans, I wish they'd, you know, download some of that stuff and check that out, because I think that's glorious music.
Oh, thanks. That was a lot of Eric's music, but we were all writing for that group, Jeff Gauthier, my brother Alex. But the lion's share of it was Eric, and he was writing like a complete madman then. He was writing so much music, and very inspired, I think, by Ralph Towner and Keith Jarrett and Bill Evans, and among other people. Wayne Shorter was another big favorite of Eric's. And later, his writing and playing became much more, I guess, what one might term straight-ahead jazz. But in those earlier days, he was writing more of, I guess, what you'd call a jazz impressionism kind of style, a lot of, I guess you'd say, not exclusively functional harmony, coloristic harmony was involved. He was half Indian, East Indian, so there was an aspect of his knowledge of Indian classical music that had made its way into his music, particularly in terms of time signatures.
Right. He studied in India, tabla, I believe.
Yes,
right?
He also played tabla.
I mean, he was one of those guys, you know. Just, I would love to. I noticed that I think you did maybe 4 or 5 records together with the quartet.
Yeah, you know, not nearly enough. The first one was a duo, and we had tons of duo music that never was recorded. And sadly, that music's all lost now, which is a whole other story. You know, Eric's story is sort of part triumph and magnificence and part tragedy and sadness.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's more coming up with guitarist Nels Klein and the Nels Klein Singers. Our program is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. I'm John Weber, and this is Piano Jazz from NPR. You know, there's a tune of yours that uses some really, really beautiful chords, the kind that I did hear with that group, the quartet music of Eric Van Essen. There's a tune called You Noticed.
Ah.
It's got that beautiful bass solo and those glorious chords in the beginning. And just, I would love to hear you guys play that one.
Okay, we should bring out our special guest, Yuka Honda, to play some piano on this, because now that we've been playing pianoless and charmed you with our pianoless sound, perhaps we have to now add piano to confound and disappoint you.
Oh, yes.
Except that Yuka won't disappoint you.
Never. These are the Nels Klein Singers with special guest keyboardist Ms. Yuka Honda. Thank you. Yeah, that was terrific, man. You noticed. Love it.
Kind of a romantic, floating space jazz piece. It's obviously a bit inspired by Blue and Green. I think there's a little Bill Evans floating around somewhere through that piece.
Yeah.
Also.
That's one of my new favorites. I hate to just sit here and watch you guys play. I think maybe we should do something together. Maybe something by Ornette.
Yes, I think Turnaround is perhaps in order. The question being, do you want to play it as a blues, or do you want to play it Ornette style and just play the head and play something after that that might be normal blues but probably won't be?
Let's see what happens.
Okay, very well.
It's because tomorrow is the question.
Ah, indeed. Thank you.
Turnaround has become kind of a standard, really. At one point, it was probably really far out, but now it's kind of assimilated into the mainstream, really. I mean, you know, but something tells me that you're not going to ever redo your artistic concept to fit whatever the pop prevailing zeitgeist is at the moment. I think you just kind of do something pretty in the studio, and then.
Well, to be honest, John, I have to confess that I make recordings pretty much for my own enjoyment, but I'm not adverse to the idea of something being singable or danceable or anything like that. I just like to have a good time and stay interested and do something that I think has feeling. You know, I think feeling is all I'm after, some kind of a felt experience. I'd really like to do a recording, and I've been talking about it for years, but I think it might get recorded of what I call mood music for Twisted Lovers. I'd like to do some standards and songs from movies and television and the theater in a way that's atmospheric and not really bold, but maybe at times a bit creepy. But seriously modeled after the idea of the classic mood music record, which was really quite the deal in the 60s. You know, if you were going to have that hot date and put something on your really cool hi-fi and turn the lights down and light a cigarette or whatever it is people were doing, it's kind of modeled on that. And I just think that it could be commercial. I don't know, you know, but I don't care, I guess is what I'm saying. If it was a commercial idea to someone, I wouldn't really be offended, but I'm not thinking of that, but people love it when you don't do your own music. So I think if the record doesn't have a lot of my own tunes on it, it'll probably do pretty well.
See, this is where I differ, because I hear the stuff that you play that you call mood music, or the stuff that you, when you're playing those really beautiful, ethereal, wonderful chords with the effects and with the singers. And to me, that's the chick magnet. I mean, if you thought playing lead guitar with Wilco was you know, working, I mean, this is the thing that I think that is really that is very, very appealing, more so than you probably believe.
Well,
we'll see. I'm having a great time with guitarist Nels Klein and the Nels Klein Singers. You can find artist information, set lists, and more on our website, pianojazz.npr.org. I'm John Weber, and this is Piano Jazz from NPR. I think I'm going to play a solo piano piece. What do you think? What should I play? Any requests?
Well, you know, Mr. Amendola and Mr. Hoff both play in a trio with the great clarinetist Ben Goldberg called Plays Monk. And so you were talking earlier about playing without a chordal instrument other than just my own or whatever. And so I'm thinking about Thelonious Monk. So anything you like in the Monk canon.
In that case, I think I'll make it Ruby, my dear.
Excellent. That was great.
Oh, thanks, man. That's Eric Clapton's favorite song.
Really?
That's what I believe. Every time I've played for him, he has asked for that song.
Wow. Well, it's not Crossroads then. That's amazing.
Well, there's more music in just a minute with guitarist Nels Klein and the Nels Klein Singers. Our program is made possible in part by the Friends of Piano Jazz and is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. I'm John Weber. And this is Piano Jazz from NPR. You strike me as a pretty mellow boss, and I'm guessing that everything you play with the singers tends to be pretty spontaneous, and that I can hear some really precise and structured passages which are executed with incredible finesse on stage. And then, yet, there's sometimes when I hear some really, really gorgeous chords, almost sounds like Tal Farlow playing. Mm. It's just lovely, lovely chords, which you played to great effect on an album called Coward, which was an album of all... Only you,
right.
Overdubbed.
And overdubbed, yes.
See, I don't know what your rehearsal ethic is with the guys. If you just kind of go on, if you bring some very specific charts and say, these are my notes, and or if you just kind of bring a loose chart and say, well, here we go, let's see what happens. Go in the studio.
Well, it varies. I mean, we haven't rehearsed a lot, but the singers, we started about 9 years ago. And when we made this latest recording, Initiate, I didn't have a lot of the music finished But I had this idea of what I wanted it to sound like, which was to say a little different stylistically, a little more groovy, a little more droney, a little less jazzy, I suppose. Not that our records could be really called jazz in the strict sense of the word, but so we actually rehearsed and kind of hammered it out and worked it into shape for 4 days in a row. And I think that's the longest we've ever rehearsed in 9 years at once, for sure. So no, we don't get into meticulous, stringent rehearsal mode. We tend to learn a couple of things here and there and play them live. And that's how they, I think, kind of become better known to us. But some of these pieces are very specific as to their parameters or their trajectory or whatever word you want to use, and don't involve a lot of improvising. You know, they're the ones that I call sort of more songs, or I like to call them my fascistic pieces. Because we kind of have to do what I say. Mm-hmm. And some of those are, well, there's one that springs to mind called The Ballad of Devin Hoff, where I'm playing an open tune guitar and Devin plays the melody and solos. And then it goes off into this kind of Brazilian Led Zeppelin thing at the end. That's just what I think of it as. I didn't think of it while I was writing it as that way. When I heard it back, I thought, wow, this is kind of like a Brazilian Led Zeppelin riff. But it's completely scripted in that sense, and the only improvisation on it is Devin's bass solo. He's playing over these changes that I had to actually sit down and listen to and transcribe because I was playing in open tuning and had no idea what chords I was playing. They turned out to almost be major 7 sharp 11 chords, though. What a surprise.
Oh, it's beautiful. You're see, a jazz chord. Ta-da. See, you are a jazz musician. You know, and I want to ask you if, it must have been loads of fun to do, but did the Bill Evans canon of all the conversations with myself records inspire to any degree your concept for that solo overdub album called?
Well, actually, it's funny you mention that because actually I hadn't thought of those records. I was thinking more of records like My Goals Beyond Side 2, two John McLaughlins and a cymbal at times, John Abercrombie's record Characters, Ralph Towner's record Diary. And in a solo sense, I guess John Fahey's records and Rod Poole's records. And yeah. Coward is really just a rather insular work of, I guess, aesthetic, sonic, overtone obsessions, and to some extent harmonic information that relates to what we're talking about, I guess. And certainly, I guess, to Bill Evans, if I did something right along the way. But also some microtonal investigations, non-systematic. I just tune things till they sound just the right kind of out of tune or something, and layered tracks for their overtone qualities at times. And I think there's a certain kind of intimacy about the record that comes through on some of the more ballad style pieces, and then on a piece like Onan Suite, I can just completely indulge myself in pretty much any ridiculous idea and a lot of more electronic explorations and layers, and kind of created a programmatic and rather ill story that only I know the plot to.
See, I loved all six parts of the Onan Suite. I thought it was terrific, and you demonstrated an obvious tremendous working knowledge of each of those stringed instruments that you played and tuned to various, I call it the tuning of no return, when you go way, way lower and I can hear that some strings sound floppier than the other ones,
right.
Some are really wound tight. And you played those beautiful chords, and many of the tunes that you play begin with those lush, kind of ethereal rubato chords. And like the tune B86.
Right, on the new record we did a little squib with David Witham on keyboard. Yuka's going to play it today. And I think that it's drawing on the same thing that you're talking about in terms of, to some extent, I guess, Bill Evans, but certainly to some John McLaughlin and specifically Ralph Towner and John Abercrombie music from the 70s. But also, I like to think of those early Weather Report records, the very first two, where and also Herbie Hancock's Mwandishi band, where Fender Rhodes piano and space jazz were the order of the day, and part of me is really never recovered from those those days and those sounds. And so little pieces like this are just supposed to refer to that aesthetic, if you will. And today we'll play it as a separate piece with just some sounds, cosmic sounds maybe at the end. And live we've been connecting it to a newer piece called Thoughts on Caetano that Yuka's also playing on. We'll just separate them today, and hopefully B86 will stand alone.
I'd love to hear B86.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that was B86. I believe the correct title is, the complete title is B86 Inkblot Nebula.
Yes, apparently B86 is the scientific term, or assignation, shall we say, for the Inkblot Nebula, which is a very beautiful nebula.
Yeah, how do you know so much stuff? Gee whiz.
I don't know anything about it. Actually, David Breskin showed me a picture of the Inkblot Nebula because I wanted to look at pictures of nebulae.
One nebula, two nebulae.
So he picked one.
I figured maybe it was from the science fiction film Destroy All Nels Klein.
Well, if only that were science fiction and not a sort of a cathartic and cataclysmic chapter of my life, it would then be so much easier to deal with.
Well, B86 is ordinarily part of a suite. You usually segue directly into a tune that you wrote in honor of Caetano Veloso.
Yeah, we've been doing that lately. I started doing it. We had a little run in South America, and they'd asked if Yuka was going to sit in with the band, and I thought, what a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? So I thought this would be something fun to do with Yuka on stage, and it's something that's current, something that's not recorded officially, and kind of uses a methodology that I associate more with Weather Report in their early days and certain ECM records from the 70s. And I think what they were doing possibly is reacting to a piece like Lonely Woman by Ornette Coleman, wherein the rhythm section is kind of motoring along on its own path, and the melody is floated over it in a rubato fashion. In this case, Scott's going to bring in a loop that he's created with prepared snare drum items, and we're going to, for the most part, ignore his groove until the end, and then we'll let Yuka cut loose with some stuff.
Fantastic. Well, that would be a great way to wrap up the show with Piano Jazz with thoughts on Caetano.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
Nels, thanks for being on Piano Jazz, man. You were terrific, and the singers are awesome.
John, what a pleasure. I can't believe we got to do this. We tried our best.
Thanks a million, man. To be continued.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Marion McPartland's Piano Jazz with guest host John Weber and today's guests, Nels Cline and his band, the Nels Cline Singers. Join us each week at this time when Piano Jazz brings you outstanding artists for conversation and improvisation. Piano Jazz is recorded at Tainted Blue Studios in New York and is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Duke Marcos, assistant recording engineer Derek Hirons, mastering engineer David Mitchell, production assistant Grant Jackson. The executive producer is Elaine Freeman. We love to hear from you. Our email address is pj@scetv.org. Our postal address is 1101 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. To find out more about the artists and music selections heard on Piano Jazz, or to listen to a recent program, visit our website, pianojazz.npr.org. There, you'll find a link to our free weekly preview podcast, Piano Jazz Shorts. Support for Piano Jazz comes from Jazz Times Magazine, delivering jazz news, insight, and advice since 1970, at newsstands everywhere and on the web at jazztimes.com. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.